Your heart pounds in your chest. Your pulse quickens. Your breath gets shorter. Your fingers begin to tingle. Your muscles cramp and tighten. Before you realize what has happened, it may already be too late. Welcome to Chicago's Ghoulish Past, Part 3, Women Who Poison. I'm Tommy Henry, and this is the Chicago History Podcast. If you are a fan of creepy stories but haven't listened to the previous Ghoulish Chicago History ones, there are links in the show's notes to help you find those. My pal Zach asked me a while back about whether I was planning to do something on one of the people in today's episode, a woman who killed the men in her life, and likely others, using poison. In doing research about her, I discovered she wasn't the only female in Chicago's history books to be caught for this crime, not by a long shot. Here are just four stories about women who poisoned those around them. Story 1. Tilly Klimek. Tilly Klimek was born Attilia Gaborik in Germany in 1876, moving to the States with her family before she even turned four. The family settled in the Little Poland area near Damon and Ashland. In 1895, Tilly married Joseph Mitkowitz, and the couple welcomed a son, Joseph, 1 year later. All seemed fine in the Mitkowitz home until January of 1914, when Joseph Mitkowitz became ill, dying 12 hours after arriving at the hospital at the age of 40. At the time of his death, Joseph and Tilly had been married nearly 19 years. The cause of death listed on the death certificate was heart trouble. Tilly quietly collected on a $1,000 life insurance policy for her late husband, nearly $31,000 in today's value. Just 5 weeks later, the widowed and obviously not so heartbroken Tilly got remarried, this time to rail worker John Ruskowski, a union that lasted 88 days until he too died suddenly. Ruskowski's death netted Tilly $1,200 in cash and $722 in insurance. Tilly, then pushing 40, was later described in the press as a, quote, crude, unattractive, and uneducated woman. And those were some of the nicer comments. But somehow she had no problem attracting suitors. It was said Tilly was a fantastic cook and made a stew that was to die for. That may have been true in more ways than one. One such suitor that became enamored of Tilly was a man named Joseph Guskowski, who also died under mysterious circumstances before the end of 1914. It was later revealed Guskowski told his sisters that Tilly confided in him that she had poisoned her first two husbands. Was Guskowski's death an accident, or had he been silenced because he knew too much? Tilly's next chance at love, or at least matrimony, was in March of 1919 when Tilly married Frank Kupczyk. It was reported that Tilly had visions about people, specifically their deaths. She was overheard telling neighbors she had a premonition about Frank dying, and that it would likely be soon. When Frank's health took an unexpected downturn, she shared her premonition with Frank. So convinced was Tilly of Frank's impending death, one day she went out and bought a coffin for Frank, excitedly telling him she got it for a bargain of just $30, a little more than $500 in today's value. According to one neighbor, she heard Tilly playing jazz on her Victrola as Frank lay dying. The same neighbor claimed she was in the room when a friend of Tilly's told Tilly that if Frank didn't have pillows under his head, he would die quicker. Without hesitation, Tilly walked to the bed of the dying man and grabbed the pillows out from beneath his head. Frank Kupsick died in April of 1921, 1 month after the couple's second anniversary. Fortunately for Tilly, Frank Kupsick left her $1,000 in life insurance. Never wanted to let the dust settle, Tilly found husband number four, Joseph Klimek, who she married in July of 1921, just 3 months after the demise of her third husband. A little more than a year later, Tilly Klimek bought a funeral dress at a local shop. When the clerk asked her who died, Tilly replied, "My husband." The clerk offered condolences, asking when he died, to which Tilly shared, "10 days from now." Unnerved by this conversation, the clerk went to the Chicago police, who then went to the Klimek house in the 900 block of North Winchester. Inside, they found Joseph Klimek lying in bed near death. On the bedside table was a bowl of Tilly's stew, which she claimed she was feeding to her husband to nurse him back to health. The dying man was rushed to a hospital where doctors assessed that Klimek had been poisoned with arsenic. The stew Tilly was feeding Joseph Klimek was found to contain the same arsenic. Police searched the Klimek home and found a box of pest control poison called Rough on Rats. When questioned about where she got the poison, Tilly said she got it from her cousin, Nellie Kulik, who lived in the area. Kulik admitted to giving her the deadly powder, but said she thought Tilly needed it to simply kill rats. Authorities also began to investigate Nellie Kulik's history and found more unexplained deaths, including some connected to Nellie Kulik's sister, Cornelia Kozlowski. Don't be alarmed by all the names. I mention them mainly because the newspapers began to refer to the group as the K Cousins, as their surnames all began with a K. The bodies of the dead husbands were exhumed, and to little surprise, they contained high amounts of arsenic. Tilly Klimek and Nellie Kulik were arrested. When asked by police why she did it, Tilly said she was fed up with the way her husband was, quote, fooling around, end quote, with other women, and wanted to get rid of him. By November of 1922, the authorities had attributed 20 poison victims, 14 dead and 6 who were still alive, to what they were calling the Bluebeard Clique, a group of murderous women. The ringleader was Tilly Klimek. In addition to the human victims, it was discovered a neighbor's dog, whose barking greatly annoyed Tilly, fell ill and was taken to an animal hospital. After lingering for 2 weeks, the dog died. The veterinarian claimed the dog displayed all the symptoms of poisoning by arsenic. Tilly Klimek's trial began in March of 1923. Newspapers at the time did not describe Tilly in flattering terms. One said she, quote, had a greasy complexion and a lumpy figure, growls instead of murmurs, and knows a crochet needle better than lipstick. I mention this because during the 1920s, all-male juries were less inclined to convict the more attractive women accused of killing their husbands or boyfriends. For some examples, check out episode 604 on the history behind Chicago the Musical. We'll be right back.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
During testimony, a nurse at the hospital where Tilly's fourth husband, Joseph Klimek, was recovering from arsenic poisoning, shared an interaction she had with Tilly. According to the nurse, Mr. Klimek, still semi-paralyzed from the effects of the poison, asked the nurse for a glass of water. Tilly, sitting nearby, shouted to the nurse, quote, "If he makes any trouble for you, take a 2x4 board and hit him over the head with it." The nurse disregarded the odd statement, but told the court that Tilly was smiling as she said it. The all-male jury deliberated for an hour and 20 minutes when the first ballot was taken on March 13, 1923. Tilly was declared guilty. When a second ballot was taken, four of the jurors voted for the death penalty. With the next ballot, all agreed on a sentence of life imprisonment. Tilly Klimek became the first woman to ever be sentenced to life imprisonment for murder in Chicago's Cook County. After hearing the verdict, the prosecutor in the case said, quote, "This will put a pausing hand on the hands of those fiends who, in the future, may think of sprinkling poison on their husband's food," end quote. After spending a year and 8 days in county jail, Nellie Kulik was freed from imprisonment after a judge declared her not guilty in the charge of providing Tilly Klimek with the arsenic she used to poison Joseph Klimek. After thanking the jailers and guards for their kindness toward her, Nellie Kulik was escorted from jail to a waiting taxi by three of her sons. Tilly Klimek died at the Joliet Correctional Center in 1936 at the age of 60 and was buried in an unmarked grave at Bohemian National Cemetery in Chicago. Story 2, Anna Cunningham. In March of 1925, David Cunningham Jr. fell ill after eating his box lunch at his job as a machinist in Gary, Indiana, about 31 miles south of Chicago's downtown. He recovered, but started to feel sick again after eating dinner at home. Cunningham went to a nearby hospital, but as they were unable to help him, he was brought to a facility in Muncie, Indiana, where doctors diagnosed his illness as arsenic poisoning. David would eventually be transferred to Chicago's Columbus Hospital, where he received a blood transfusion and other life-saving measures. Based on the amount of arsenic in David Jr.'s body, police took his mother, 49-year-old Anna Cunningham, in for questioning. Looking more closely into the Cunningham family history, investigators discovered Anna Cunningham's husband, David Sr., died in 1918 while the family lived on a farm in Valparaiso, Indiana, about 60 miles southeast of Chicago. He was 56. At his death, the couple had been married nearly 19 years. The surviving family members then moved to Gary, Indiana. 2 years later, in 1920, 18-year-old Isabel Cunningham died after a two-week illness. 1921 brought a double dose of death to the Cunningham family with the sudden passing of Charles, 19, in September of 1921, followed 1 month later by the death of Harry, 23. And then, unbelievably, unless you've been listening to this podcast, 10-year-old Walter Cunningham died after a 10-day illness in 1922. Two assistant state's attorneys from Chicago left the city to travel to Crown Point, Indiana, to request the exhumation of the five bodies buried nearby in the span of just 6 years. Of what was once an eight-person family, only the mother, Anna, son David Jr., and a daughter, 18-year-old May, were left. It would be revealed that each of the five deceased family members were insured for $2,000 to $3,000 at the time of their deaths. On the low side, the $10,000 the policies paid out were about $184,000 in today's value. On the high side, nearly $275,000 today. Was this enough money for someone to slowly and methodically kill three sons, a daughter, and a husband? In April of 1925, Anna Cunningham signed a confession, which she later recanted, claiming she was so overcome with loss after the death of her husband, she wanted to end her own life, but didn't want to be without her favorite children. She fed them butter and sugar sandwiches with small amounts of arsenic, which slowly and painfully ended their lives. Anna Cunningham said she also ate sandwiches with arsenic, but somehow she was not affected. She said she had nothing to do with the deaths of her husband and oldest son, Harry. As for why her daughter, May, was spared, Anna said she was the least liked. Anna Cunningham was brought to trial in the murder of her young son, Walter. After deliberating for 26 hours, the jury returned their verdict: guilty. Anna Cunningham later tried to explain her motive for killing one child at a time using poison. Quote, "Something seemed to draw in my head and told me I had to get rid of them. I thought that I was going to die and wanted to take them with me. I only poisoned the ones I loved best, and I poisoned the ones I liked best in turn because I wanted them with me." Cunningham's son, David, still in the hospital in Chicago, refused to believe his mother could be responsible for the crimes for which he was convicted. Anna Cunningham, who was referred to in the press as Gary's poison mother, began serving her life sentence in the women's prison in Indianapolis in the fall of 1925. After all of the hoopla surrounding this case, Anna Cunningham was paroled in June of 1933 after less than 8 years behind bars, after an investigation into the crime convinced members of the prison board at the Indiana Women's Prison that she was innocent of murdering her son. Anna Cunningham left prison and took up residence in Gary, Indiana, with her daughter and son-in-law. Anna Cunningham died in October of 1945 at the age of 72, still living with her least liked daughter, May. No mention of her troubles with the law were included in her death notice. Story 3, Margaret Summers. In May of 1931, 17-year-old Thomas Myers died at the home of his aunt, 48-year-old Margaret Summers, at 632 West North Avenue in what is now Chicago's Old Town neighborhood. The teen, who was an orphan, had been ill for nearly a year and suffered from partial paralysis. The coroner, seeing signs of poisoning, ordered an inquest into Thomas Myers' death. Margaret Summers was taken by police to the Hudson Police Station to answer questions. Sidebar, I get really distracted by police station names in these stories, which then sends me down the research rabbit hole. For those of you wired like me who want to know about these things, the Hudson Police Station was at the corner of Blackhawk and Hudson, which is just west of Sedgwick and south of North Avenue, which is where the 36th District was based. Station, built in 1906, closed in December of 1961, and was later torn down. Where was I? The dead teen's aunt, Margaret Summers, suggested that the youth may have been poisoned from chewing wallpaper, which, according to Summers, was a habit the boy had. The coroner declared the idea absurd. Investigators looking into Margaret Summers discovered, wait for it, multiple deaths of those connected to her. In August of the previous year, Margaret Summers' husband Thomas, known as Shags, died at age 37. According to his death certificate, the cause of his demise was neuritis and heart disease. Other men who had died, seemingly of natural causes, included William Ryman, 49, a peddler, the teen victim's father, Lewis, and another man, all had lived at the Summers home at one time. The four older men had insurance policies that, when added together, were valued at $5,700, nearly $116,000 in today's money. Early news stories indicated that the recently deceased teen gave his aunt his daily earnings from work before he got sick, and that the boy also had an insurance policy which named Margaret Summers as recipient of a $2,500 payout in the event of his death. Another of the boy's aunts was named as a beneficiary of a $1,300 policy, but that aunt expressed the belief that the boy was poisoned. Margaret Summers' deceased husband and the other men were exhumed. Three of the bodies showed signs of slow arsenic poisoning. One victim's death was due to ingesting a large amount of poison in a short period. Margaret Summers claimed to know nothing about the manner of her husband's death, but did say she knew of his alleged affairs with other women. Margaret Summers went on trial for the poisoning death of her nephew, Thomas Myers, in February 1925. During the trial, it was revealed that Margaret Summers had taken out 9 insurance policies on the teen boy's life, which would have paid out $3,630, roughly $74,000 in today's value, had she not been caught. On one policy, Summers forged the boy's signature. Other men that knew Summers came forward, including a cab driver who had lived at Margaret Summers' home as a boarder and had become ill. The cabbie said he knew of one insurance policy taken out on him by Summers. He did not know about the other 3 policies Summers had taken out on his life. Investigators unearthed 19 policies taken out by Summers on 10 different people. Summers maintained her innocence. Her husband? He died of heart trouble. The boarder died after contracting a cold. One of the other deaths was from stomach ulcers. And according to Summers, her 17-year-old nephew had been ill with a septic sore throat and spinal meningitis. But how had she poisoned all these men and the boy, Thomas Myers? At the trial, 2 witnesses came forward to share that they had purchased flypaper sheets for the defendant in the 2 months preceding the boy's death. The prosecution contended that Margaret Summers had been soaking the flypaper sheets, which contained trace amounts of arsenic, in water, creating a weak arsenic solution. Drinking this arsenic solution over many months eventually took its toll, killing the boy. Margaret Summers, testifying on her own behalf, admitted to purchasing the flypaper, but said she did so because during the warm months, quote, we were making beer and there were a lot of little flies around. The jury deliberated for less than 4 hours before they returned a guilty verdict, sentencing her to 14 years in the women's reformatory in Dwight, Illinois. The judge, after overruling a motion for a new trial, commented, the jury was more lenient than I would have been. Story 4, Nancy Wassman. This next story has no insurance policies and no trials, but it does have poison and death. Friday, January 2nd, 1942. La Glone Café at 22 East Ontario Street, where Ontario meets Wabash Avenue, was buzzing. Promoting its cultured European atmosphere and internationally famous French cuisine and southern seafoods, La Glone claimed to have the greatest wine cellar and variety of fine wines and liquors in Chicago. At 9:45 that night, the front door swung open, and in walked a nicely attired couple. The man, dressed in a suit, appeared to be in his late 40s. The woman, a decade or so younger than her dinner companion, wore a red evening gown. The couple asked their waiter, Gino Morisi, if they could be seated in a private dining room. Morisi was happy to comply. The cozy couple ordered a pheasant dinner and a drink, a bottle of 1928 Pommeret Grenot Rems champagne, which ran $9.50 a bottle, nearly $180 in today's value. After finishing their meal at about 11:30 p.m., The two told the waiter they did not wish to be disturbed. The waiter, respectful of their request, left them alone to enjoy their time together. Slightly more than an hour later, at 12:45 a.m., the waiter, ready to end his shift, went to the private dining room to check on the couple. Tapping lightly on the door, he received no response. Had they snuck out? Had they fallen asleep? Were they too busy inside to hear the waiter's knuckles rapping against the door? The waiter listened for a moment, then knocked more loudly. Pushing hard against the door, the waiter was finally able to get inside the private room, only to find a horrifying sight. Inside the small room was the couple, sprawled on the floor, dead. In the bottom of the champagne glasses, according to the news story in the Chicago Tribune newspaper, was a brackish and evil-smelling red substance. A card in the man's pocket identified him as 50-year-old Claire McArdle, a vice president and general sales manager of the Missouri-Portland Cement Company in St. Louis. McArdle resided in Clayton, a fashionable suburb of St. Louis, with his wife Lucille and their 16-year-old daughter. Investigators also found membership cards in the man's pocket for the Missouri Chamber of Commerce and the Missouri Athletic Club, as well as an uncashed check made out to McArdle for $1,207.36, about $23,000 in today's money. As for the dead woman, she was not Mrs. McArdle. She was 39-year-old Nancy Wassman, who owned a hair salon at the Sheridan Beach Hotel at 7301 North Sheridan in Rogers Park. Wassman and McArdle had been carrying on an affair for 5 years, but his wife had gotten suspicious. Nancy Wassman, fearing McArdle was about to end things, asked him to come to Chicago so they could talk. At one point during dinner, Wassman excused herself to make a phone call, a call made to the adulterous man's wife. Wassman pleaded with the man's wife to give up her husband, which she refused to do. Wassman hung up the phone and returned to the private dining room. When McArdle wasn't looking, she opened a compact she had in her purse and discreetly dropped a few grains of poison into his champagne glass. The poison worked quickly. According to doctors, it would have taken effect immediately, killing the adulterer in 5 seconds or less. Nancy Wassman watched him die, then she herself drank a poisoned glass of champagne. Their deaths were later ruled murder-suicide. If she couldn't have him, no one else would. I do hope you've enjoyed today's episode about Chicago's ghoulish past and the women who poison. As always, I'd love to hear from you if you have any questions about anything covered today, anything to add, or have a different topic you think might be a good fit for a future episode of the Chicago History Podcast. I can be reached by email at chicagohistorypod@gmail.com. Thanks, as always, to the original boogeyman himself, Jaundiced John K. Schneider, for creating the Chicago History Podcast logo and much of the art used on the social media pages. He can be found at AngelEyesArtJKS on Instagram or via email at AngelEyesArtJKS@gmail.com. If you want to help me out, please take a moment to like, follow, and kindly review this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and tell a few friends. It helps us get the word out and reach new history fans and fans of ghoulish Chicago stories. Get out and explore when possible. Learn more about whatever city you live in and stay safe. Thanks for listening.